caused her death was going to walk away, and any footprints left behind were going to grow fainter and fainter until there was no trail at all. The detectives who had worked their way back through Cheryl's life and through Brad's life found themselves against a brick wall. Cheryl's murder went unsolved. At least it went unprosecuted, because all of their evidence was, thus far, circumstantial. On Sunday, September 21st, 1986, Brad had had ample time to drive from the Madison Tower to the West Slope area to meet Cheryl, to strike her on the head and face 24 times, to send her van containing her body onto the Sunset Highway, and to drive back to his apartment. No one had seen him between 7:35 and 8:50. But a man cannot be arrested because he hated his wife and because no one had either seen or talked to him for an hour and 15 minutes, not even if his wife had died a brutal death during those 75 minutes. If Brad had killed Cheryl, he had found a place to wash himself clean of blood afterward, although blood spatter experts would one day testify that cast-off blood from a bludgeoning weapon doesn't necessarily land on the killer who holds that weapon. When Lilia Sarnan saw Brad at 7:35, he had been wearing casual slacks, just as Sarah recalled. Sarah never again saw the wine-colored shirt that Brad had worn to the American Dream Pizza Company earlier that evening, although that was something else she hadn't volunteered to the police during their initial investigation. If Brad washed up, no one knew where he had done it. When Rachel Houghton saw him entering the garage around 9, he was wearing shorts and a T-shirt. He was barefoot, and his hair was wet. That was 40 minutes after Cheryl's estimated time of death. Had he come through the pool area of the apartment tower? Had he stopped in a gas station restroom somewhere along the way home? Had he made it back to his apartment without being seen at all and washed up in his own kitchen or bathroom? These questions had never been answered. Cheryl Keaton's co-workers at Garvey, Schubert & Bearer had felt a certain sense of serenity after the memorial service they held for her in Seattle's public market the week after her death. "We did have closure," managing partner Greg Dallaire said, "but we expected the police to do something." Civil attorneys are not usually trained in criminal law, nor are they any more aware of police procedure than someone in an entirely unrelated profession. It's necessary to be caught in the middle of a criminal case, in one manner or another, to really understand how very difficult it is to bring criminal charges against a murder suspect and then to actually convict that defendant. But Oregon State Police Detectives Jerry Finch and Jim Ayers hadn't forgotten Cheryl. Washington County Prosecuting Attorney Scott Upham and Assistant DA Bob Hurd hadn't forgotten her. Nor had OSP Sergeant Jim Hinckley and his wife, OSP criminalist Julia Hinckley. Every officer and every paramedic called to the side of the Sunset Highway on the evening of September 21st, 1986, remembered Cheryl Keaton. But they didn't have enough to arrest someone. Brad remained their only suspect, but they couldn't bolt under pressure and arrest him too soon. Brad also remained the prime suspect in the minds of Cheryl's family, friends, and colleagues. Greg Dallaire and other partners at Garvey Schubert knew that Cheryl had been convinced for months before her murder that Brad was going to kill her. They knew that she had begged her friends to see that her boys didn't go to their father if she should die. They knew that, fearing she would die, she had done everything humanly possible to prevent Brad from gleaning one penny from her estate. Cheryl had insurance, and her estate had money coming from her Garvey Schubert retirement account. "The firm also gives $5,000 in the case of death," Dallaire said. "We didn't want to give it to Brad, and we were concerned about the kids. We did hire a Portland attorney to help get custody from him so that the boys could go to Betty and Marv Trosseth, but Brad was taking care of them, and we couldn't prove otherwise. That petered out. Sharon Armstrong, Kerry Radcliffe, Eric Lindenauer, and Dallaire were extraordinarily frustrated as they saw everything that Cheryl had feared become reality. Both Sharon and Kerry had tried to be emotionally supportive of Cheryl, as only women can be with one another. Neither of them could be with her on the last weekend of her life, and they may well have wondered if things would have been different had they been there, if somehow, some way, they might have protected her. It would be only natural. Eric Lindenauer had been there for Cheryl as often as he could be. He had made the trip to Bridal Mile School with her to try to protect her and the boys from Brad's rage, but he couldn't be with her all the time. No one could, and in the end, all Eric had been able to do was call the Oregon State Police the day after her death and tell them about the horror she had been living through in the months before her murder. Greg Dallaire had never been as close to Cheryl. He had seen her around the office, of course, and had lunch with her once or twice, but she had almost always seemed happy and vibrant. Dallaire was a gentle man, a man who used his legal knowledge to help others. In 1970, he set up the first battered women's program in America through his work with the Evergreen Legal Services in Seattle. He had never realized how emotionally battered Cheryl was. When he did, it had been far too late to help her, and he agonized over that. 3 months had passed since Cheryl's death, without an arrest. It was early 1987. Somewhere, her little boys had their first Christmas without their mother, but none of Cheryl's former co-workers knew where. Brad and the boys had completely disappeared. As much as they wanted to fulfill the promises that Cheryl had extracted from them, the promises that they wouldn't let Brad have her little boys, they had no legal avenue to stop him. He was their father. Their mother was dead. And if Brad had killed Cheryl, no one had yet found a way to prove it. Yet it didn't seem possible that someone as alive as Cheryl could die so horribly and that no one would be punished. "We went to Hillsboro," Dallaire recalled. "Eric Lindenauer and myself. We talked to Bob Hurd and Jim Ayers. They said that they were attempting to put a case together, but they told us it was a circumstantial case. They said, 'We know he did it, but—'" The civil attorneys were learning more about the criminal side of law than they had wanted to know. Some months later, they returned to the Washington County Courthouse and talked once more with Bob Hurd. "All he could tell us was that it was still under investigation," Dallaire said. 18 months after Cheryl died, Lindenauer and Dallaire traveled again to Hillsboro. They could sense at once that their meeting with Bob Hurd, Jim Ayers, and Jerry Finch would not be a fruitful one. None of the three men seemed to want to meet their eyes. They made small talk and glanced at the thick files in front of Hurd. Finally, Hurd took a deep breath and spoke the words that he didn't want to say and none of them wanted to hear. "We're declining to prosecute." The room was silent as the words began to sink in. Dallaire and Lindenauer were stunned and disappointed. More than disappointed, they were outraged that Brad seemed to have beaten the men and women who had been on his trail for 18 months. "The cops were unhappy," Dallaire remembered. "You could tell they didn't like this decision." The five men in the room all wanted the same thing, although they were coming at it from different angles. There had to be some way to construct the case against Brad Cunningham that would hold up in court. Cautiously, they explored the possibility that a civil case might be brought against him, a case that, if successful, might put enough pressure on Brad to force his hand. If, Dallaire began, "if we brought a case that would establish civilly that he killed her, would that be helpful?" The room was silent, and then Hurd, Ayres, and Finch said, "Yes," almost in the same breath. "Yes, that would help." It was a backdoor way to convict a suspected killer who had apparently escaped every criminal investigation ploy, but it was a way to begin. The Washington County DA's office provided Dallaire and Lindenauer with a copy of the police files on Cheryl's murder, and Ayres and Finch offered whatever help they could give. Dallaire returned to Seattle carrying a heavy box of files. Alone, he began to read the official follow-ups that described Cheryl's death and the aftermath. "I was devastated," he said later. He read the autopsy report in horror, fully aware for the first time of how brutal Cheryl's murder had been. He tried to visualize the sunny, bubbly, brilliant young woman he had known and, for the moment, could not. He decided he couldn't share the awful details of her murder with most of his staff. And then Dallaire came to a copy of the note Cheryl had left behind as she went to meet her killer. He held it in his hand, unbelieving. "I have gone to pick up the boys from Brad at the mobile station next to the IGA. If I'm not back, please come and find me. Come right away." It was almost as if Cheryl was in the room, talking directly to him. "I was flabbergasted when I came across the note, and I got really angry," Dallaire said. "I thought, why didn't they do something?" Maybe there hadn't been enough for the prosecutor's office to go with a criminal charge against Brad, but Dallaire knew that the note he held in his hand was enough evidence to bring a wrongful death suit in civil court. At the next executive committee meeting of the law firm, he went in and said, "Do something." He got no argument. Everyone at Garvey Schubert who had known Cheryl was anxious to do whatever they could to bring her some modicum of justice. "We figured we had two ways to go," Dallaire recalled. "We had some money that was in her estate, Cheryl's profit sharing, and the $5,000. We thought, let's wave the money in front of Brad like a red flag, and he'll sue us. We can get him into court, and we can prove wrongful death." The second plan for hoisting Brad on his own petard was more complicated. There had been a murder in Washington State on July 26, 1974, that had eerie similarities to Cheryl Keaton's. Ironically, the killer, Anthony Fernandez, had come from Longview just as Cheryl had, although it was unlikely she had ever known him. Fernandez had been in prison on fraud convictions by the time Cheryl was in high school. Tony Fernandez was 48 and a paroled con man when he met a pretty 42-year-old widow named Ruth Logg in Auburn, Washington. He didn't mention his criminal background, of course, to Ruth. He appeared at her door to look at the house she was offering for sale. He told her he was Dr. Anthony Fernandez and was in the process of setting up a counseling practice in Tacoma. He even showed her an article from a local paper announcing the opening of his practice. Ruth was a wealthy woman, as Fernandez noted when she showed him around her sumptuous home. As it turned out, he didn't have to buy the house. He simply moved in. Despite her family's reservations, Ruth Logg fell in love with Dr. Anthony Fernandez and married him 6 months later. With his counsel on financial affairs, she changed her will so that he would inherit everything she had, uncharacteristically disinheriting her two young daughters. 2 years later, Ruth suffered what appeared to be a tragic accident. The Winnebago motorhome she and Tony had rented plunged off a dirt road on Snoqualmie Pass in Washington's Cascade Mountains. Ruth was found dead halfway down a steep embankment. The Winnebago was 150 feet further down the slope. She had succumbed to a fractured skull and a blow to the stomach, but she had no wounds that pathologists would expect to find in someone who had gone over a cliff in a vehicle. Tony Fernandez survived. He hadn't even been in the Winnebago. He told authorities that Ruth had driven away from their campsite and he had followed 20 minutes later in another vehicle. Washington State Patrol investigators and detectives from the King County Police were suspicious of him, but they were working with a highly circumstantial case. There was no arrest. 18 months after Ruth Log Fernandez died on a lonely mountainside, her daughters brought civil action against the man who had by then spent most of the assets of their dead mother's estate. Judge George Revell found that Anthony Fernandez participated as a principal in the willful and unlawful killing of Ruth Fernandez. The aspect of the landmark Fernandez case that appealed to the Garvey Schubert partners was the fact that Fernandez was then charged criminally with the murder of his wife more than 3 years after her death, and he was subsequently convicted and was serving life in prison. We decided on our second option, DeLea remembered. We would go for the civil trial. The committee at Garvey Schubert told us, go forward. We wanted to shop this case out to a lawyer to see if there might be something there. Eric Lindenauer started looking around because he knew Portland attorneys. John Burke backed us up. At that point, no criminal charges had been filed against Brad. Not in 1986, nor in 1987, or in 1988. The world went on for everyone, except for Cheryl. But nothing was over in the pursuit of her killer. Everything was only suspended in time. It wasn't as easy to find an attorney to go up against Brad Cunningham as the Garvey Schubert partners had originally thought. As it turned out, there were few attorneys in Portland who were not already familiar with Brad. He was a most litigious man, and it was his policy to consult several attorneys on each of his legal actions before he chose one. After 3 or 4 turndowns, Dallaire and Burke and Lindenauer realized that finding an attorney willing to joust with Brad would be a challenge. Lawyers with families said they didn't want to chance it. One said, I have a daughter who walks to school alone. I won't risk taking him on. Try Shin. He said that Mike Shin, while he certainly enjoyed the company of women, had no wife, and he was notorious for loving a good scrap. That's what the attorneys from Garvey Schubert needed. They knew it would be far safer for a prosecutor to go up against Brad in a criminal case. If he were convicted criminally, he would go to prison and wouldn't be a threat to anyone for years. But if a civil attorney should prevail, Brad would still be free. It would be a moral victory, and it might well be the springboard for a criminal charge. But even with a win, Brad would be as free, for a period of months, as he was at the moment. And if, as the lawyers who were about to set a net for him believed, he was a devious and dangerous and vengeful man, the civil attorney who brought him down would have to watch his back. Nobody but an attorney with a rebel streak, a maverick, would touch this dicey case. Mike Shin was indeed a maverick, descended from a long line of mavericks. His great-grandfather was William Jasper Kerr, one-time president of Utah State University, Brigham Young University, and Oregon State University. Shin's mother Miriam's ancestors had come from Pennsylvania by wagon train, members of a religious commune with a charismatic but eccentric leader. They made it to Oregon and found the community of Aurora. His great-uncle William Kerr was the U.S. prosecutor for the Japanese war crimes trials, the Asian equivalent of the Nuremberg trials, and Shin's father, Bill, was an underwater demolition expert in World War II, a fearless swimmer whose assignment would compare to Navy SEALs today. Tragically, Bill Shin died of cancer at 42 when his only son was in high school. Mike Shin was a natural athlete and particularly gifted at football. He was one of the fastest and most nimble quarterbacks the Willamette University Bearcats ever had. He wasn't very big, but but he was smart and he was tough. Like his father before him, he excelled at risk-taking. In 1968, the Bearcats were ranked number 3 in their division in the nation. They were led by Mike Shinn, who threw for 1,508 yards and 18 touchdowns. The whole 1968 team was inducted into the Willamette University Athletics Hall of Fame in 1993. In his 40s, Shinn was still a risk-taker and a dogged opponent. In his 40s, he played world-class rugby and checked the weatherman's wind forecast before he glanced at his schedule for each day. If the wind was going to blow, Shinn was going to be out on the Columbia River windsurfing. He was a bored head and, like all windsurfers, hopelessly addicted to gliding across the water as fast as he could, wrestling with his sail to stay upright. Actually, Shin's major in college was English. "What I really wanted to do was go to film school and make movies or go into publishing," he said. "I never thought I was smart enough to go into law because I could never figure out who did it in the Perry Mason shows." Shinn turned out to be a lot smarter than he thought he was, of course. "I ended up in law school at Willamette," he said. After Willamette, Shinn clerked for a federal judge and then did some criminal work. "The last criminal case I defended, I got a guy acquitted of 5 bank robberies," he recalled, "and I figured it was a good time to quit criminal law while I was ahead." It was late summer of 1989 when Mike Shinn listened as Greg Dallaire and Eric Lindenauer took him through the tragic details of Cheryl Keaton's death. John Burke was on the phone, a participant in this hard sell. Ideally, they were hoping to convince Shinn to undertake the civil action against Brad on a contingency basis. Shinn was intrigued by the case. He remembered reading about Cheryl Keaton's death on the Sunset Highway, though he hadn't heard anything more for 3 years. Still, as he listened to the twists and turns the investigation had taken since 1986, he realized that this would be a colossally complicated case to prosecute civilly, criminally, or anyway. "There were 3 reservations I had about taking the case," he said later. "One of them was the very concept of filing a civil suit against a man for murder when he'd never been indicted. You don't have the constitutional protection that you do in a criminal case. My second reservation was that I might get killed. I knew 2 other lawyers who had looked at the case and said, I don't want to expose myself to this kind of risk." When Shinn was told that Brad was now married to Sarah Gordon, that further complicated his decision. "The 3rd concern was Sarah," he said. "I remembered her as a real perky, bright-eyed, intelligent, energetic, charismatic, neat lady. But it wasn't just Sarah. It was the idea of the kind of grief that would be brought to bear on the whole family. I didn't know the kids, but it was inevitable. We never asked for it, but this was the kind of story that was going to lead to big headline coverage." Shinn realized how much time it would take, how many contacts would have to be made, how many hours would be billed by private investigators, and suggested that he be paid by the hour. He couldn't afford to take the case on a contingency basis. Brad had allegedly gone through millions of dollars, and no one knew if he had anything left. Even if Shinn won a civil suit against him, his cupboard might very well be bare. "It was going to be such an undertaking for me," Shinn said. "It would mean doing little else. I told Dallaire and Lindenauer that I was willing to do it, but I'd go bankrupt if I did it on a contingency basis." He estimated that the civil case would cost about $50,000, but he couldn't be sure. "If Cunningham has any money left," he told Dallaire and Lindenauer, "he'll probably hire someone like F. Lee Bailey, and unlike other cases, there's no bottom to this until the guy gets convicted of murder." Dallaire never blinked at the $50,000 figure, or at the possibility that it might be more. He took the information back to the executive committee, and they signed off. We entered into an agreement with Mike Shinn in 1989, but we had to be cautious, Dallaire remembered. We were afraid that Brad would find out what we were doing by somehow seeing certain bills. We were the client hiring Shinn, but we didn't want Brad to know that. On paper, then, the client was John Burke for Cheryl's estate, but Garvey Schubert was paying Mike Shinn. If Brad hired a lawyer to face off John Burke, we were concerned that he would find out the firm was paying and we'd have to grant discovery. And, too, if Brad should find out how many people from his past Shinn's private investigators were prepared to interview, he might try to intimidate them so that they wouldn't talk. He was demonstrably a past master at intimidation. Going into what was inherently a criminal case for the first time in many years, Shinn was a little apprehensive, but he moved ahead. He filed the civil suit, and it did indeed make headlines in the Oregonian. "One of the first things I remember is getting a letter from Sarah," Shinn recalled. It said, in essence, "Gee, I haven't seen you in 10 years. I thought you were a nice guy. And now you've done this horrible thing to my family." She also wrote that all the employees of the Broadway bakery that she and Brad owned had walked off the job and that her son's friends wouldn't play with them or return their phone calls. Shinn felt rotten. But he had anticipated that Sarah would be angry and he would just have to live with it. "The next letter I got," he said with a grimace, "was from Brad's first lawyer. He said there wasn't a scrap of evidence against Brad. Brad had told him that probably John Burke killed Cheryl. Then Brad's lawyer threatens me with disbarment and a lawsuit. I'd met Greg and Eric, but I didn't know John Burke beyond his voice on the phone. I wasn't sure who the bad guy was. Sometimes I even wondered if it was Burke, if somehow I was being set up." Not sure what was going to develop, but now totally committed to the case, Shinn went ahead with traditional discovery work and the filing of motions. Brad was scheduled to file his first deposition in early 1990. "The night before, I get a phone call," Shinn said. It was from one of Portland's top attorneys, Forrest Reakey. He had Brad Cunningham in his office, along with Wes Urquhart, a bigger-than-life Texas lawyer from Vinson and Elkins in Houston. It was Brad's opinion that Shinn's suit had been filed to keep Brad from prevailing in his Houston lawsuits. "It became like guerrilla warfare," Shinn remembered. The first shots from both sides had been fired in the case, but Shinn had yet to learn how tenacious Brad could be and how calculating. If he had known that he was stepping into a runaway stagecoach whose horses were about to stampede, would he have said no to Greg Dallaire and Eric Lindenauer? Probably not. Mike Shinn always loved a good fight. Chapter 37. There's a rule of thumb in homicide investigations. The chance of finding and convicting the guilty person or persons diminishes in inverse proportion to the time that passes after the crime is committed. Given a choice, detectives want to catch the killer in 24 hours. They feel fairly comfortable with 48 hours. After that, they wonder if they will ever solve the case. Mike Shinn was reopening a murder case that was almost 3 years old. He wasn't a criminal attorney, and he wasn't even a crime buff. All he really had to bring to this project was a new point of view, a brilliant legal mind which he hid beneath a somewhat sardonic wit, and an inborn refusal to give up long after anyone with common sense would have thrown in the towel. He had his own negatives. Not only had too much time passed since Cheryl's death, but he knew the Washington County District Attorney's Office was not particularly happy to have a civil attorney take on a case in which they had exhausted all possibilities. It was akin to an internist striding into an operating room, seizing the scalpel from the surgeon already in the middle of an operation and saying, "Let me do it. I think I see where you're going wrong." Human nature being what it is, D.A. Scott Upham and Mike Shinn were probably not fated to be best buddies. Criminal prosecution works under different guidelines than civil trials. To prove a case criminally, the judge or jury must be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that a defendant is guilty. That is, a reasonable man, after hearing the evidence and the testimony of witnesses, could come to no other conclusion. A civil case is proved by a preponderance of evidence. A judge or jury weighs the evidence presented by each side and decides which has the most compelling argument. Thus, it follows naturally that a civil case is easier to prove. In the end, after all the investigation by the Oregon State Police and Upham's own office, they had concluded that they did not have enough evidence to charge Brad with Cheryl's murder. That didn't necessarily mean that Upham and his staff, or Jim Ayers and the other detectives who had followed Cunningham's movements with keen interest for the past 3 years, believed he was innocent. They felt in their gut that he was guilty, but they doubted that they had enough firepower to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. If they arrested him and tried him, and he was acquitted, they could never try him again. Double jeopardy would attach. All detectives and prosecutors can cite cases where they know full well that a man or woman is guilty but is still walking around free, and probably always will be, unless he or she commits another crime. It's not one of their favorite topics. Brad was still walking around free, and Shinn hoped to uncover something that everyone else had missed, but he didn't really think he would. Only Perry Mason did that, and Shinn had never been able to second-guess Mason. Shinn started with nothing but a 3-ring black binder, the summary of the police investigation of Cheryl's murder in 1986 and 1987. If he was lucky, somewhere in that list of witnesses and law enforcement personnel, he might find someone whose perception and recall would help him in his civil case. "I didn't really expect to find new witnesses," he said. "I hoped to expand on the witnesses who were around. Maybe my style was different, I could analyze differently, and my philosophy was different. I had the advantage of coming into this case fresh." To re-interview people who had not been very receptive to interviews in the first place was going to take some innovative and empathetic private investigators. As he always did, Shinn went to experts for advice on how to find the best. "Steve Howes is one of a handful of the best criminal defense lawyers in Oregon, and I asked him who he would recommend as an investigator," he said. "I told him about the case and that, although this was a civil case, it was going to be almost like prosecuting a homicide. I need an investigator who's used to doing criminal work." Howes pondered Shinn's question and then said, "Well, the very best investigator in the state is Chick Preston, but you can't have him because he's working for me." "Later," Shinn said, "I found out I'd played football against Chick when he went to Whitman University." "Second," Howes said, "would be Connie Capato, but she's working on the Dayton Leroy Rogers case right now." Shinn grimaced. Rogers was a suspect in the serial murders of Portland prostitutes whose bodies, their feet neatly severed, had been found in a lonely Oregon forest. Fortunately, Connie finished her work on that case in time to help Mike Shinn. Connie Capato had come to the field of private investigation by a circuitous route. At one time she had considered becoming a nun, but found that the religious calling was not for her. She liked people, she was good with people, and for her the calling of the PI was a better way to connect with them. Along with Connie, Shin hired another female PI, Leslie Haig, who worked in Connie's business, CLC Investigations. When it came time to file the complaint and serve Brad with the official notice, Shin didn't know where he was living. Somebody had heard he was working for a donut shop or something. Eric Lindenauer thought that was hysterical because he'd known Brad as this hotshot bank executive. I was sitting in the Y in the sauna room one day going through the downtowner, and there was a picture of Brad. It says, "New guy on the block," and there's Brad with his new Broadway bakery. "So that's how we found him," Shin said with a laugh. "With great detective work." So I called Connie's office and said we needed someone to serve the complaint. She said she'd send Leslie Haig over, and I said, "Maybe you'd better send a guy." When slender little Leslie showed up, Shin had his doubts. "This case has some elements of danger, and that's why I asked for a guy," he told her. "This guy you're serving a complaint on is suspected of murdering his wife." Her eyes sparkled, and she said, "Oh, really? That's interesting." "Yeah, it's interesting, but it might be dangerous. Are you sure?" Leslie was sure. Shin arranged to have a male PI follow Brad when he left the Broadway bakery after Leslie had served the complaint, and Leslie promised to return to Shin's office and report on how Brad had reacted to the news that he was being sued in civil court for responsibility in his former wife's death. She was back in a short time.
"I went in the bakery," Leslie reported. "It's a really nice little place. And there was this long cafeteria kind of line you stand in, and Brad Cunningham was at the end of the line."
"Yeah?" Shin asked expectantly.
"So I got to Brad, and he said, 'Can I help you?' And I told him I had some papers for him. I handed them to him."
"Yeah?"
"He read them."
"Did he say anything?"
"Yes, he did. He said, 'Thank you.' And then he looked at me and said, 'Would you like a muffin?'"
For weeks after that, Brad Cunningham was referred to in Mike Shin's office as the Muffin Man. A civil suit accusing a man of murder was not the kind of story that a newspaper would ignore, and the Oregonian and the wire services did not. The headlines hit in July 1989. Lawsuit blames husband for spouse's death. Portland, Oregon. AP. Family and friends of a slain lawyer have filed a $15 million wrongful death lawsuit in Multnomah County Circuit Court against her estranged husband. Court documents say that for months before she was bludgeoned to death on September 21, 1986, Cheryl Keaton had feared she would be killed by her estranged husband, Bradley M. Cunningham, a developer, entrepreneur, and banker. But neither Cunningham nor anyone else has ever been charged in Keaton's death. Despite an investigation that a prosecutor called exhaustive, the homicide case remains open. Portland lawyer Michael Shin filed affidavits and court documents to support the lawsuit Monday. The wire services quoted an outraged Brad Cunningham, who said that the lawsuit was clearly an abuse of the legal system, the result of a vendetta against him by John Burke, the personal representative of his wife's estate. He said that his three sons, 9, 7, and 5, who lived with him and his new wife, believed that their mother had died in a car wreck. "It's very upsetting to me that the system will let someone go and file something like this," Brad told reporters. "It was bad enough to live through the death of my wife, and now we have to live through this, just when we thought life was normal again." When Shin's legal assistant read the paper, she was appalled. She had no idea what he had undertaken, and she didn't like it when she found out. "I'll never forget," Shin said. She read the article in the paper, and she walked into my office with her hands on her hips. She just looked at me and said, What have you done? And within a few days, she resigned. Shin didn't really blame her. It was going to be heavier and more dangerous work than any legal assistant in her right mind would choose to take on. But he was now involved in what would be the biggest case of his life, and he didn't have a legal assistant. He had never needed a good right arm more than he did at this moment, and he realized a little ruefully that he was going to have to find a woman who was something of a daredevil, as he was. Shin went to several attorney friends and asked if they knew of anyone who might meet his rather unusual specifications. He was looking for someone who would work overtime and have an uncanny ability to talk to people and get them to trust her enough to share secrets they had kept for years. She would have to have the soul of a detective, and she would have to be utterly fearless. One of Shin's former partners, Mark Bocci, heard him out and then said, "You should have asked me before. I know who you need. I know the one who's the best in the state of Oregon, and she was looking for a job, too, but she just got hired. She's working for a company that defends civil cases." "See if she's really happy there," Shin urged. "See if she'll leave and come with me." The best legal assistant in the state turned out to be Diane Baker, a slender and striking blonde in her 30s. Fortunately for Shin, she was already bored with her new job, and she was intrigued with the Cunningham case, listening avidly as Shin gave her an overview of what lay ahead. "There's a negative to this," he said finally. "If you come in on this, there's likely to be some danger." He looked up apprehensively, expecting that he was about to lose any chance he had with Diane. Instead, she was grinning. "She lit up like a Christmas tree," Shin recalled. "It turns out she's fascinated with true crime books. Diane is into the serial killer of the week and all that stuff that I knew nothing about. I didn't read those kinds of books. Diane did. Nothing scared her. It only whetted her appetite for the job. I was fortunate that she came on this project. I never could have done it without her." Brad Cunningham, who had accepted his complaint papers with such seeming equanimity, was not the sanguine muffin man at all, of course. He had the capability of being a sinister and dangerous presence, and he resented some guy named Mike Shin interfering with his life. "It must have been the fall of 1989, a few months later," Shin remembered. "We were at Jake's, and I was having dinner with Dave Jensen, who was president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association 2 years after I was. We were still on the board together. We were standing in the bar waiting for a table, and Dave asked me if I had anything interesting going on. I said, 'Funny you should ask.' So I was telling him about this Cunningham case. Then we moved to the tables near the bar to eat, and we were sitting there, still talking about the case. I'd noticed out of the corner of my eye that some guy seemed to be looking at me. All of a sudden he looms up over me, and he's got this funny grin on his face. He leans over and he's kind of peering at me, and he says, 'Are you Mike Shin?' I was trying to figure out who he was, and I thought maybe he was an old fraternity brother. I was trying to buy time to remember who he was, and I said, 'Yeah, I'm Mike Shin. How you doing?' He says, 'I just wanted to see what you looked like.' Then he turned on his heel and walked away. Dave says, 'Who in the hell was that?' And suddenly I knew who it was. I said, 'That was him.' I just made the connection, and then I looked closer at the woman he was with, and it was Sarah." Shin's encounter with Brad was brief. He would remember only that the guy was big and dark. He didn't expect to see Cunningham again until they met in court, if he showed up in court. He sure wasn't showing up to give depositions. Chapter 38. Brad had more problems than the legal action against him. His fifth marriage was turning sour. Marital fidelity or even discretion had never been part of his makeup, and his falls from grace were becoming more transparent. By February 6, 1990, Sarah could no longer talk herself into believing that her marriage was working. Half the time, she had no idea where Brad was. Most of the rest of the time, she knew he was with Lynn Manero. She knew because she had hired a private investigator to follow him. That day, she told Brad she was thinking about divorce, and he barely reacted. Despite his flat reaction, Sarah was worried because he had been very ill the night before. She tried to find Brad when she had a little time away from the OR or when she could get to a phone. She called him and got no answer or got the answering machine. Brad always had a reason why he couldn't answer her calls. "I was on hold on another call." Or, "The machine was turned off accidentally." Or, "The phone stopped ringing just as I reached for it." Brad was running both the Broadway bakery and the bistro now, as well as delivering lunch orders. But he had a cell phone, and there was no legitimate reason why Sarah could never reach him. Half angry and half worried because of his history of heart problems, she kept trying to locate him. Sarah jotted notes in her journal for February 6th. 11:50. Called bistro. Lynn answered. Said Brad had been back. She gave him message. He left again to deliver sandwiches. I asked her if he was okay. Yes, Lynn answered. He seemed okay the little bit that I've seen him. I said, "You picked him up this morning, didn't you?" She said, "Yes." Sarah finally got a call back from Brad an hour later. She had agreed to pay a $12,000 retainer to a divorce attorney. Brad had no money. He called to say things had gone fine with the attorney. I said I was concerned about him. He sort of grunted. Then said he didn't believe me. I said he was scaring me. He said he was sorry, didn't mean to. I asked him if he loved me. He said, "Sarah, we have to talk, but I can't talk now." 13:40. I called Brad. Asked him if he was able to talk now. He said he was too busy. He said he didn't think he'd feel like talking today. Said he felt like going out and having a few drinks tonight. I said, "With me?" He said, "No, maybe just by myself." He said he felt like I wasn't being honest with him. Wouldn't be more specific. Just in general, I was not being honest with him. Brad was a master at projection. He could turn criticism away from himself as if it were a boomerang that he could direct back the way it came. He told Sarah that afternoon that he felt she didn't love him, that she was dishonest, that he wouldn't answer her questions anymore. "He feels I grill him, and that he might want me to move out. I'm not the person he thought I was." Brad told Sarah he was upset about everything, the civil lawsuit that Mike Shinn had filed against him, the fact that she had been talking to a divorce attorney, too, the knowledge that he had been followed for the past 4 or 5 days. It was true. She had grilled him, and she had had him followed, and his answers never matched the truth. At that point, if Brad had made any effort toward reconciliation or any admission of his culpability, Sarah might have stayed in the marriage for the sake of Jess and Michael and Philip. She might even have still loved Brad on some level, though she didn't trust him. Perhaps she wanted to trust him. The next day, Brad packed his pickup and left for a trip to Seattle. Sarah was certain that Lynn had gone with him, but she was surprised later to see Lynn and her husband Gary together. Sarah and Gary had talked. They were both worried that their marriages were crumbling because of an affair between Brad and Lynn. Sarah got more response to her concerns from Gary than she did from Brad. In fact, she already considered her marriage over, and she had made plans to move out of the big gray house in Dunthorpe and find an apartment in the new Portland complex at River Place. Brad didn't seem to care one way or the other if she left, and Sarah didn't tell Gary that she was leaving Brad. Brad didn't get back from Seattle until Saturday afternoon, February 10th, and he left the next day for Houston. After she drove him to the airport, Sarah took Jess, Michael, and Philip to look at the River Place Athletic Club. The boys hoped to join, and it would be a way for her to see them often. Brad called Sarah the next day from Houston, but it wasn't a pleasant conversation. He was furious with her because she had talked to Gary Manero.
"Lynn's going to quit the bakery now because you're trying to ruin her marriage. If she quits, I'll quit too," he fumed.
Enough. How much more was Sarah expected to take from Brad? She had gone to the bakery once late at night and found Brad alone, but Lynn's purse was sitting out in plain sight. She had found Lynn in the restroom, and Lynn looked anything but innocent. It had happened again, or close to it. When Sarah drove up to the bakery one night, she recognized Lynn's car parked in front. She discovered that someone had taken the bakery key from her key ring, and by the time Brad let her in, minutes had gone by. There was no trace of Lynn, but when Sarah left, she saw that Lynn's car was gone. All this had taken an emotional and physical toll. Sarah's resting heart rate was way over 100, she was afraid even to take her blood pressure, and her weight was under 90 pounds. Sarah rented a studio apartment at River Place. She had bought the big house for the boys, and she wanted them to be able to live there and go to school where they had friends. Above all, she didn't want them to be uprooted one more time. She would move and would continue to pay the mortgage on the big house so they would still have their home. "I was prepared to make the payments on the Dunthorpe house until the boys were grown," Sarah would say later. "I wanted them to be able to stay there, to have some stability, even if my marriage to Brad was over." Sarah and the boys picked Brad up at the airport when he returned from Houston. They went out to eat, and Brad started to tell his sons that he and Sarah were splitting up. She begged him not to do this in public, but he had said too much already. Michael and Philip started to cry, and Jess bit his lip. "The boys drew wonderful pictures for us to stay together," Sarah wrote sadly in her journal. "Brad and I talked for several hours. He was surprised that the boys were upset." That astounded Sarah. How could Brad not know that his little boys would be hurt by yet another loss in their lives? Their mother had been dead for only 3.5 years. They had bonded with Sarah, and now she was their mother, both legally and in terms of love and caring. She didn't know how she could bear to leave them. She had been going to counseling just to find the strength to do it. If Brad would let her have the boys, she would be overjoyed, but she knew him better than that. She had had a ringside seat to his terrible battle with Cheryl over the boys. The most Sarah could hope for was that Brad would let her see them and that they would still know how much she loved them. She agreed to sign a lease on a Volvo station wagon so that Brad would have transportation for the boys. He couldn't get a lease in his own name because of his bankruptcy. "I always think of February 16th as a kind of anniversary," Sarah said later, not without a trace of bitterness. "Brad and I met early to go over property settlements before meeting with Al Menashe, Brad's attorney." Brad had already met with another attorney who had told him that Sarah should pay him between $8,000 and $10,000 a month child support. Sarah was surprised and explained that she was currently spending $8,500 on the bakery bistro and $3,000 on malpractice insurance. She said if she gave Brad what he felt he should have, "that left very little for me." She remembered his reaction vividly. "Brad said he knew how much I liked to work, and now I'd have more time to work." Sarah stared at this wonderful man she had once loved so much. He was a stranger. But something happened that day that completely changed Brad's treatment of Sarah. From the bistro, he spoke on the phone with one of his criminal attorneys about this pesky civil case that some lawyer named Mike Shin had filed against him, and for the first time he seemed to grasp how dangerous it could be for him. The lawyer told Brad if he was found civilly responsible for Cheryl's death, he might very well face criminal charges. Brad finally perceived that he stood a very good chance of actually going to jail. He had laughed off Shin's suit as ridiculous. Now one of the best attorneys in Portland was telling him that it wasn't funny. Brad later told Sarah that his lawyer also advised him to keep his marriage intact. Having a woman like Sarah beside him, a woman with a fine reputation in the Portland community, would make his acquittal in the civil trial far more likely. It would not look good for him if he was going through yet another divorce while he was being sued civilly over the death of his fourth wife. It was at precisely that moment that Sarah walked into the bistro. Brad was a pale shade of gray, and there were beads of sweat on his forehead. This was not the same man who had sneered, "I know how much you like to work, and now you'll have more time to work." He was frightened. Brad had a revelation on that February 16th, Sarah would remember Riley. The man who hung up the phone clung to her like a lost child. Brad became almost non-functional with the realization of the gravity of the civil suit, Sarah said. His attitude toward her changed from bitter sarcasm to tender affection all in the space of a few hours. He was on the phone with his attorney when I walked into the bistro. He begged me to stay around the bistro with him. He felt better just having me around. His behavior toward me changed totally. He loved me and needed me. He needed his family to be together. He couldn't handle the boys being sad about my not being there, etc., etc. His whole demeanor toward me changed to how it used to be. I told him I was in no hurry to leave and could stay until his lawsuit was finished. But Sarah was not deluded. She knew that Brad needed her only as window dressing during the civil trial. She didn't try to get out of her lease at the River Place apartment. She kept it as her escape spot. Brad helped her move a bed, a table, a sofa, and some chairs to the studio apartment. She knew that she would be leaving the marriage soon, but she relished the reprieve she had been given to be with her little boys. On February 21st, 1990, Sarah lived through one of the most bizarre nights of her life. She met Brad for drinks at the exclusive Alexis Hotel in Portland, and they talked. He said that he was thinking of moving to Seattle or to Colorado Springs when this is all over. She didn't know if he meant their marriage or the civil trial. She didn't care which, but she started to cry because if Brad moved so far away, Jess, Michael, and Philip would be far away too. Later, Sarah wrote down the events of that night in her journal. Brad became depressed when I told him I wouldn't stay with him after the lawsuit. Too much pain for too many months. All of his lying to me, etc. I left for home, the Dunthorpe house, so Rhonda, their babysitter, could leave, and Brad went for a walk. He called me a little later from the Morrison Bridge and made it sound like he was considering jumping. I called the cellular phone a couple of times, but he didn't answer. Brad's threats to commit suicide had worked once before when Sarah had said she was leaving him. She had capitulated and promised to stay with him. But this time she was weary of his games. Brad simply used these threats to bring people into line. Besides, the Morrison Bridge was so close to the water. Even if he jumped, he would only make a small splash and get wet. There were higher bridges in Portland, much higher, if Brad was serious about killing himself. Later, he called me from the East Bank Saloon, Sarah wrote. Said he would like to have some hope that we might stay together, wished that I would just lie to him so that he could have that hope. Brad eventually got home about 10:15 p.m. I was in bed sleeping. He wanted to talk, and I told him I needed to sleep. He got out of bed, said he should just end his life, and started reaching for the gun in his closet. I got up, pulled him away from the closet. He went downstairs, and I followed. He started crying. "I want my daddy."
I tried to talk to him into going to the hospital for help, but he wouldn't.
Sarah watched in horror as Brad got a box with a gun in it from a cupboard in the laundry. She was pretty sure he wouldn't shoot himself, but she wondered if he might just shoot her. I was scared beyond belief, but stayed calm. I told him I wanted to leave, and he said to go ahead. I had to go upstairs to get my purse and keys and grab a coat. I only had my Mickey Mouse nightshirt on and Jess's slippers. I was very frightened that he would get the gun while I was upstairs. Brad allowed Sarah to leave the house. She drove away with tremendous relief and went to Providence Hospital. She called the house a couple of times, but Brad didn't answer. She knew he was trying to make her think that he had indeed killed himself. Sarah realized too late that she was dealing with a manipulator, a master puppeteer. She had no idea yet to what lengths Brad would go to get what he wanted. She had begun, however, to wonder what had really happened to Cheryl. Chapter 39. Mike Shinn's private investigators, Connie Capato and Leslie Haig, had set out to walk through Brad's past to find the women he had married and divorced, the mother and the sisters whose existence he barely acknowledged. Somewhere in that past, some of it decades old, they might find enough to help Shinn in his civil suit against Brad. Connie Capato found Lonnie Ann Cunningham in Brooklyn, New York on August 24, 1989. Although she had not lived with Brad for 17 years, Lonnie Ann was still afraid of him. Theirs was the only one of Brad's divorces where money was not an issue.
"Neither of us had money," Lonnie Ann said. "It was Brad's power and dominance over me. He punished me by getting at me through my children."
With Capato's promise that her whereabouts would never be revealed to Brad, Lonnie Ann began to open up. Her marriage had been hellish, she said, full of emotional and physical abuse. She had dreaded Brad's moods. Sometimes he hit her when he didn't even seem to be angry. She might be watching television and he would hit her and say, "Take that for a lesson," and then sit down and watch with her as if nothing had happened. Lonnie Ann detailed the disintegration of her life with Brad from the time she was a happy young bride until the last terrifying days when she actually feared for her life.
"In the beginning he would argue, and then he would throw things and then hit me. At the end, he would walk in the door after having a bad day and start beating on me."
Lonnie Ann confided that Brad had a history of fighting going back to high school. If there was a fight going on, Brad would do anything to get involved, even if he wasn't part of the fight in the first place. She said Brad had told her that he and his friends had a good time going downtown in Seattle and beating up winos and queers.
"One time he beat up one guy so badly that he didn't know if he had killed him, but he didn't stick around to find out."
Lonnie Ann said the most frightening time of her marriage was when Brad had worked at Gals Galore. Whether it was true or not, he had always talked as if he was heavily involved with organized crime figures. She described his reaction once when he was picked up for parking violations. She told Capato that Brad was livid that his fingerprints were on file. Lonnie Ann also told Capato that she thought he had a lot of money, although you could never prove it by his paperwork. Every time she had tried to file for support to help raise her children, Brad managed to look like a pauper on paper. Whenever Kate and Brent visited their father, they came home and told Lonnie Ann about the hundreds and hundreds of dollars in cash and all the material things their father had.
"He would talk about how he was giving his current three sons three-wheelers and very expensive toys, and Kate and Brent basically got nothing. It was as if he was throwing it in their faces that if they came to live with him, he would give them things, but since they didn't, he wouldn't give them anything."
She told Capato about the time Brad had taken Kate to Houston,
but when she asked Lonnie Ann if Kate would testify about that, she shook her head. Kate wanted only to be as far away from her father as she could be. Lonnie Ann had had a difficult time surviving when she was alone with Kate and Brent. One of the things that Brad would do was write support checks and then stop payment on them, she said. He knew that if the welfare department believed I was receiving support from him, they wouldn't give me any money. I couldn't cash his checks, but the welfare people wouldn't give me money either. Hesitatingly, Lonnie Ann told Capato about the terrible night when Brad had left her, drunk and disoriented, standing on the cliff above the river. And as for Cheryl's murder, she had thoughts about that. She felt that if Brad had paid someone to kill Cheryl, he would have made sure that many, many respectable people saw him in the vital time period. Since no such witnesses had come forward, she said that Brad himself had probably beaten Cheryl to death. Lonnie Ann had been frightened that he would murder her during their divorce and custody battles. Lonnie Ann told Connie Capato that she had never known anybody who was so vindictive and had such a strong need for revenge and control as Brad. That was the major reason that she had fled the Northwest and found work as a kinesiology therapist as far away from him as she could get and still be in America. Asked if she would testify against Brad in the civil trial, she turned white and stammered, "No." She wasn't even sure about a deposition. There was no guarantee that Brad wouldn't come after her. Even if he was found responsible for Cheryl's death, she knew he wouldn't be locked up. Connie could see how afraid Brad's first wife still was of him, even though he had had four other wives since she divorced him. She asked if Lonnie Ann would think about giving a videotape deposition that Mike Shin could present in the civil trial. Lonnie Ann said she would think about it. Leslie Haig located Brad's older sister, Ethel. Ethel, who went by Edie, was living in the Northwest, although she, like most of the women in Brad's past, didn't want her address revealed to him. Unlike Lonnie Ann, Ethel wasn't hesitant to relate her memories of her brother. She remembered him as being violent since his high school days. He had beaten her, and he had beaten their mother. Ethel regretted that she had persuaded Brad to marry Lonnie Ann when she became pregnant at 17. She hadn't realized the abuse that Lonnie Ann had suffered in her marriage. She was just beginning to establish a relationship with my husband and me, and she finally opened up to us. Ethel looked at Leslie Haig and confided, "I have no doubt in my mind that Brad murdered Cheryl. What is so sad is that all the women who have been involved with Brad truly believed that he wouldn't hurt them. They believed that he loved them." Ethel had never really known Cheryl, not until near the end of her life. They had talked in the spring of 1986 after Cheryl and Brad had separated. Ethel had offered to help Cheryl in her divorce and custody proceedings, and she had invited Cheryl to her daughter's wedding. Ethel said that Cheryl had told her about one time when Brad disappeared for 2 weeks. Cheryl had asked him where he'd been and why he had left. "Brad's response to Cheryl," Ethel said, "was, 'If I ever hit you, I'll kill you.'" Cheryl had called her the Friday before she died and told her about the deposition she had given a few days before. "She told me, 'I'm going to nail him. I'm not going to let this happen.' I begged her, 'Don't be alone this weekend. He'll try to get